Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Jane Thin. Jane is a novelist, journalist and broadcaster. Her first novel, Patrimony, was published in 1997, and she has since written more than 10 others. Widowland is her first novel published as C.J. Carey. Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you for asking.
No, not at all. So we're here to talk to you about your novel Widowland, which was released earlier this summer in hardback. It is set in 1953, in an alternative history in which a grand alliance between Great Britain and Germany was formed in 1940. Great Britain has become an outpost of a Nazi German empire. It's a world not unlike that of Philip Dick's The Man in the High Castle. So what inspired you to write this alternative history?
So I've written a whole series of novels set in and around Europe, in pre-war and wartime Europe. And I thought for a long time and had been tantalised by one of the great what ifs of history, which is what if Edward VIII had stayed on the throne and not abdicated in 1936? And we know that if he had stayed on the throne, we would be very likely to have formed an alliance with Nazi Germany. And so, like a lot of people, I'm very interested in how England and Britain would have been a different place under that alliance. And eventually I gave in to my yearnings and wrote an alternative history book, which was very different from a straight history book. And I thought, I'll really let my imagination go and see where it takes me.
That's so interesting. So you talked about documentary evidence that suggested that Edward VIII would have made an alliance with the Germans. What evidence is there? Is it letters?
So certainly letters have come to light in which Edward VIII has urged Nazi Germany through an intermediary to bomb England as heavily as possible in the interests of peace, which is pretty much treacherous in itself. But also, what's always tantalised me is the meeting that Edward VIII had in 1937 on his honeymoon at the Berghof. So once the abdication had happened and Edward and Wallace had retired to France, they decided to go on honeymoon, and they accepted an invitation in Nazi Germany, scandalising everybody in England and all the establishment. And they were toured around, and they were very much exploited by the Nazi regime. And the whole visit culminated in a meeting at the Berghof. And there's a famous picture of Wallace and Edward meeting Hitler and just outside the Berghof. And then Edward was secluded in a room with Hitler and an interpreter called Paul Schmidt. And we don't know what happened in that meeting. And so it's always been tremendously interesting to speculate on what Edward agreed in that meeting. We know that Hitler very much thought that he would be a good king and that Wallace particularly would be good as a queen. And the speculation is that Edward made a series of concessions as to how he would rule in the event of an alliance. So that's always been the absolute crux of my interest. And so I decided to have a look in Widowland at what would happen had that come to pass.
So you talk about how you've written before historical novels, and then this is your first counterfactual alternative history novel. It's also the first novel you've written under a different name. Is there a link between those two?
Definitely, because I've always really striven, as any former journalists have, although I suspect your listeners will laugh at this, but to actually follow historical accuracy and not change dates and actually really not kind of wreak events out of their chronology, etc., and to be faithful to historical detail. So in writing 11 historical novels, I've really, really tried to not speculate too much, but actually eventually I thought it would be fun to do, and so I'll do it under a different name. And because it's a sort of quite a feminist novel, I chose my mother's maiden name, and it's my own initials for first. But there was a very interesting moment in which the publishers said, actually, if you write under initials, it might delight your readership, because men quite like reading wartime stories, but they don't tend to, you know, evidence suggests that they don't tend to write fiction with women's names on the cover so much. So actually, I think that's proved to be the case. And I think it's far more male readers than I would have had otherwise.
So if we want to talk about the kind of feminist aspect of the book, it's a deeply dystopian as well as alternative history book. Women in this outpost of the German Nazi Empire are classified based on their appearance, fertility, and potential skills they can contribute to the country, from Gailies down to Frieda's, who are single women with no children and who live in the Widowlands. How did you go about developing such a system? Was there a historical basis?
Absolutely. The novel I've just written was spanned the whole of the war in Berlin. And at the end of the war, the German regime issued different rations according to somebody's occupation and their age and their status. And that's quite normal for ration administration. But there was the bottom of the ration pile were women over 50 with no man and no children. And these were nicknamed in civilian wartime Germany, Friedhofsfrauen, which means cemetery women, because they were kind of useless. They performed no role in society, so they didn't need much food. And so I was very struck by this. And when I created the society in which women are actually in a caste system, the very bottom of the caste, and very bottom caste, are nicknamed Frieders, and they are women over 50 with no man and no children. And in the world of Widowland, they are made to live in run-down, desolate outskirts of towns and corralled together with the very lowest amount of resources. But the flip side of that is that if you have a whole load of over 50s women corralled together, one thing you do know is that they're quite likely to be a very literate group of people who love literature. And so in the world of Widowland, the Widowlands are the place that is the most literate part of society. And literature is also absolutely central to the book. One of the other inspirations of Widowland is this, in that when I was researching the role of Alfred Rosenberg, who was a kind of Nazi philosopher guru, character in Nazi Germany, I discovered he did a very strange thing. We all think of Nazis as burning books. That's the great totem and emblem of Nazi Germany, the pile of books in Bebelsplatz. But actually, what he did was something more interesting. He got together an SS task force of scholars, and he sent them through occupied Europe into the libraries and private collections of books. And he had them rewrite history books to reflect the National Socialist ideology, which seemed to be such an extraordinary, punctilious, incredible thing to do. But this is what his team of scholars did. And so I extrapolated from that. And in the world of Widowland, Rose is protector of Great Britain. And he's deemed that the books that need to be rewritten are not only history books, but also English literature. Problem with English literature is a lot of the great books in English literature are written by women. And they show a world in which the heroines of the books, we think of Jane Eyre, Lizzie Bennet, Dorothea Brooke, happen to be intelligent, sometimes slightly unruly women who challenge the dominance of men. And this would go very much against Nazi ideology. So in Widowland, Rosenberg has decided that the great classics of English literature need to be rewritten. And the person chosen to do most of the rewriting is my heroine, Rose.
So your heroine, Rose, her job is to rewrite the books, and she struggles with Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, and Little Women, which you might think might be slightly easier to rewrite for a Nazi audience, but as she finds out, really isn't. And she also writes her own stories secretly in notebooks, which is also a key plot point of the book. When I was reading this, I was struck by the fact that her job isn't unlike that of Julia in 1984. In some ways, and you must have met with many comparisons to have A Handmaid's Tale. Do you think you were influenced by other dystopian books?
I think we're all influenced by everything we've written. So, I mean, I think everybody's consciousness, individual consciousness, has filtered everything you've ever written. I mean, I hadn't read 1984 since I was 16, so I had the whole bit about the fiction department I'd completely forgotten. But strangely, yes, so definitely there are echoes of dystopias, undoubtedly. And the interesting thing about dystopias, I reflect, is that they're very often written as warnings. I mean, if you think of Brave New World, written in 1923, it was before mechanisation had really taken pace. And if you think of Orwell's books, they seem to be prophecies. They seem to be written before. The funny thing about Widowland was, which portrays this bleak Britain where nobody, all the borders are shut, nobody can travel. There's very strict limits on socialisation. You can't meet in groups of more than three if you're going to discuss books. I wrote it all before the pandemic, and I'd finished it before COVID appeared. And it seemed incredible to me that actually suddenly, one moment you finish the book and the next moment there's this kind of hideous thing in which the borders really are shut. So Rose's sister in the book is actually quite pleased that she doesn't have to go on holiday anymore and says, you know, why would you want to go abroad when you could go to Felixstowe? So I had wanted to study how a British population would have reacted to an authoritarian regime and the restrictions that that would involve. And horribly, suddenly, we get the evidence in real life of how people would react.
Yeah, and the idea of people applying for passes to go abroad felt all too real.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, so many of the things. But one of the other main strands of this novel, based in 1953, so actually 13 years after the alliance has been formed, and one of the key things the regime has done is to try and reduce the amount that people read. Obviously, they've decided with classic novels, you can't just erase them in a general. So you've got to alter them, but generally they want to reduce reading, and that was something I wanted to think about, because I think we are having a generation that's reading much less, and it does to people if you don't read so much, and how reading and particularly the point of an individual in front of a novel is a moment of intense liberation, because you are literally an individual consciousness meeting another individual consciousness across time, and that is something that's very hard for a government or a regime to control, and that's why reading is such a subversive and dangerous activity.
I think that's so true, and I was particularly struck by the books that you chose to be so important in the novel. So Afroban at one moment is a very key code word in a sense, and Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley, Mary Wollstonecraft being the mother of Mary Shelley, are also incredibly key to the book. Were these conscious choices? They must have been. What influenced you to choose Wollstonecraft, for example?
Oh, because Vindication of the Rights of Woman was such a kind of manifesto text. I mean, it was so important because she was really the first serious female writer in Britain that actually started talking about women's equal rights and the importance of female education. So, you know, she's a real rallying point. And so what she does in the book, or obviously she doesn't appear in the book, but the groups of widows who are rather subversive have started daubing public buildings with graffiti, samizdat lines from English literature. And the first one that Rose sees is one by Mary Wollstonecraft talking about the importance of opening women's minds. And so, you know, just seeing these lines, and I wanted to get the feeling for Rose, of who isn't a reader, it's just not a reader, you just don't really do that kind of thing, of having to plough through the great text in order to kind of correct them and abridge them, and becoming enlightened by reading them. And that process where at one point, for example, when she's reading Jane Eyre, and she's looking at the treatment of of Bertha Mason, the first wife of Mr. Rochester, who's kept in the attic, as we know. And initially she thinks, well, this isn't a problem, because, you know, this is totally in accordance with alliance ideology, you know, he's looking after her, she's in the attic. Why shouldn't he take another wife? And then gradually she realizes. And so I wanted to get that moment of kind of growth where she kind of realizes, and it happens to coincide with an assassination plot. So that's good.
I think you really achieve that growth, and the description of her sitting down with Middlemarch as well is particularly striking. There's also the brilliant moment where she alters probably one of the most famous direct addresses in all of English literature, "Reader, I married to him," to "Reader, he married me," yeah. Which is just damning, isn't it?
Very important, because, you know, individual female agency, which is what Jane Eyre was all about, and that, as you say, that single line, I thought that has to change. So that was really fun, actually. It was fun to just to look at the classics and think how you've changed them. But then, of course, Rose, I also wanted to tackle another one of the great kind of, it's sort of almost one of the great sort of hoary chestnuts of 20th century literature, which is, what if Hitler had been assassinated? And I thought it'd be fun to have an assassination plot in the mix as well, to make it more of a thriller, which it is.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the assassination plot. I don't want to ruin the end of the novel for anyone who's listening and hasn't read it, but a manuscript of Frankenstein is very, very key to the assassination plot. And it's a book that was written by a very young woman in competition with other more famous writers. And I wanted to ask about why you chose that novel to be so important.
Well, as you say so rightly, it's partly because the ultimate scene takes place in the Bodleian Library in the Radcliffe Camera, and which is where I've spent many, many hours. And also that is where there is an edition of Mary Shelley's book, Frankenstein. And the story of Frankenstein, for anyone that doesn't know it, is that it was the year when the eruption of a volcano meant that it was very, very grim weather. There was no sun. And Mary Shelley, with Shelley and Byron, had gone on holiday to Byron's Dr. Polidori, I think, had gone on holiday in Switzerland, and they were stuck indoors because the weather was terrible. And somebody had the idea of having a horror story competition. Everybody would write a horror story. And Mary Shelley was 18, and she sat down and wrote Frankenstein, which was much better. I mean, anything that Shelley wrote or Byron wrote that day is completely forgotten, but Frankenstein became this great classic. And people didn't actually believe, people thought probably her husband, Shelley, had written it afterwards, but you can see her handwritten manuscript. And so that was very important. It was really, you know, important to think that she had achieved this, and it has this famous line in it, "Beware, for I am fearless and therefore powerful." And it's also about a German genius who creates something fantastical, which is exactly what Hitler would have imagined would be a great thing, you know, and that's how they frame it in the book. You know, it's about this German genius, but actually it's such an amazing novel and so influential. So yeah, I was really glad to get Mary Shelley in there, and the fact that she was obviously the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft's just extra.
It's really perfect. It creates this sense of a parallel generation of women far, far older than the current generation who are struggling with illiteracy and a lack of power. As we've already discussed, the most subversive group of women in your novel are those who live in the Widowlands, and in part their line, "fearless, therefore powerful," applies to them the most, because they have pretty much nothing to lose in many senses. So they remember literature and give a book club a more radical insurrectionist purpose than it might otherwise have. When I was reading it, I was struck by the fact that a lot of literature, from classic literature to all heroines, tend to be quite young. A lot of heroines are 18, 19, 20. And old women often aren't given agency in books and novels. Was this something that you were consciously thinking about as you were writing?
Totally, 100%, absolutely. And I also thought, I mean, some people have said to me since that we wanted more of the widows, and my protagonist is 26, and she is in a way, you know, fairly standard, young, unmarried, attractive, you know, protagonist of a novel. But at the same time, I wanted the widows to be the powerful ones, and in the sequel, I've got more involvement of the widows, because yeah, absolutely, that I thought they're not getting a say and they need more of a say, and the powerless, the fearlessness, and the regime, the Minister of Culture says this is the great problem with these dreadful old women, that they've got, you know, they have nothing, so they fear nothing. And I wanted to encapsulate that fearlessness that does come with getting older, and you know, and not having to care so much, you know, and that because they are now in this desperate situation, they haven't got to worry so much. And so I definitely wanted that to come across. And it's obviously the moment of the older woman has, in literature, I think, has sort of come.
Yeah, I think that's so fabulous. So the widows in your book live in an outskirt, a very rundown, gated off outskirt of Oxford. The houses feel kind of reminiscent of terraced houses in Cowley or Jericho in your descriptions. I don't know if that's accurate. But and then Rose lives in a flat in Bloomsbury, but devoid of all connotations of the Bloomsbury set, those degenerates. And her sister lives in a big requisitioned house in Clapham. So the houses have been distributed according to the different caste system. What was it like imagining not only a 1950s England that had never been bombed, so a very different one to the one that actually existed, but also one that was altered by a complete different way of organising the people who lived there?
Oh, that's so much fun. And actually, that is actually the challenge. So obviously, you've noticed that Jericho is where I set the Oxford widow land, but there are widow lands all over England. And indeed, Rose lives in Gordon Square in Bloomsbury. And I think it's not hard, really, to imagine elite areas. I mean, we have kind of people that live in Hampstead and people that live in, you know, Catford. So it's not really difficult to picture a city which is divided into pockets of the elite and the kind of much less elite. But the fabric of how London would have been different was enormously good fun. And you have to keep reminding yourself of the war's not happened, what isn't there, you know, there's no bomb site, you know, you've still got all the medieval buildings that were destroyed in the war. And so that's been a really enjoyable thing to do. And actually, in the sequel, I've paid even more attention to the fabric of London and what ultimately, I think, if we had had an alliance, the Nazis would have done with London, which would be something completely different.
That's really interesting. It's bizarre to think of London in which we don't have such clear bomb divisions. On my road, for example, right at the end, there's a block of flats and you can tell on a map that a bomb hit there.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, what I'd say, the fun with the sequel is speculating what would Albert Speer would have done if he'd got hold of London and decided to redesign it in the way that Berlin was. He was in the midst of redesigning Berlin and did quite a lot of redesigning in it. And one grotesque piece of that was that if he found an area that was, you know, run down, didn't like it, he literally did clear those areas. And clear is a sort of dreadful euphemism for what happened in those areas. So I like the idea of a Speer designed London as a true horror story.
So the London Library also plays a very significant role in your book, and the London Library is a beautiful Victorian library set up in, I think, the 1840s, maybe, in St. James's Square in central London. And it houses so, so, so many beautiful books. And in your book, it is also an area where Rose can go to do research for her rewritings. Did you write any parts of this in the London Library, or?
Oh, I spent so long in the library. I mean, I really, you know, that the Bodleian and also the London Library are there. It's obviously no coincidence, because I spent lots of time sitting there. I love the London Library. And But I also, libraries are one of the great Nazi paradoxes, because Hitler was very, very interested in libraries and wanted to build the biggest library in the world in his hometown of Linz in Austria. And the Nazi ideology, the horror of it lies often in the paradox that people who are notionally cultured and love Wagner and love reading books are also capable of this level of brutality. And so I genuinely think if Hitler had visited England, that what he might well have done, and which happens in the novel, or is planned in the novel, is that he makes a tour of Britain's libraries, and he wants to see what the libraries are like. And this is just, it's just a fact of that particular leader, that he was also obsessed with libraries. And so I thought, I've got to have some libraries in here. And that's why they're there.
I loved reading about the London Library as well and imagining it in the 1950s. So a slightly different question, but your book touches obliquely on the Holocaust and what might have happened if Britain had also fallen under the power of the Nazis. Did you feel a significant challenge of writing about something so distinctly real and horrible and awful alongside counterfactual history? Was there a tension there?
There's a huge, yes, of course, and that's always a difficulty, actually, of any writing set in that era, or the era of wartime, or anything to do with the Nazis, is that to what extent the huge domination of the Holocaust is reflected in your novel. But, I mean, the fact about Widowland, and which is, I think, tremendously significant, is that all news from the outside world has been shut off. And I wanted to get the idea of a population, which is not a hard idea to imagine, who have no access to foreign news. They don't have foreign newspapers. The broadcasts are jammed. People don't visit. And actually not really knowing what's going on. Now, this is actually not strange. We know that it happens in a lot of countries, North Korea and East Germany spring to mind. This idea that actually people don't really want to know, they don't know, B, an awful lot of people don't want to know, and if they are told, they'd rather not know. I'm very struck by a real life incident, which is called the Frankfurt Trials, which happened in 1965, in Germany. A lone prosecutor decided that he wanted to prosecute a man who'd been a guard at Auschwitz, and it was a great, ultimately became a huge celebrated trial, but at the time it was an uphill struggle to get this prosecution to happen. And I've seen vox pops that broadcasters did at the time, when they stop people in the street in Frankfurt and say, look, Frankfurt trials, have you heard of them? And what do you think of Auschwitz? And people just look blank. People say, I've not heard of Auschwitz. I don't know what you're talking about. And so although there is this great belief that every single German in the world was told about Auschwitz and had it drummed into them at school, and I'm sure a lot of that did happen, at the same time, people are so willing to forget, people want to forget, people don't want to know about horror and have it ever present. So the idea of having a Britain in which the wider Holocaust is not really understood or known about isn't actually such a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. And I think you do capture the sense of a nation where any form of outside information is incredibly cut off. And there's a scene where Rose is tuning the radio to a station which brings in news from America. And then she gets so scared that her downstairs neighbour might hear. And so she stops, which is really, really brilliantly done. So you've mentioned the sequel to Widowland a couple of times, and without ruining the end of Widowland, it ends on quite a cliffhanger. When the sequel comes out, will there be any, I mean, you can't ruin it, but please tell us about the sequel.
There is a sequel. It's set 3 years later, and it's called Queen High, and Wallace is on the throne, and the widow's there again, and things have become more acute and alarming. And I very much also wanted to harness the feeling that I think we've got after the pandemic of how the dust settles And yet the essential problem is still there. You know, it's how people struggle to get on with life when they haven't actually resolved the main problem. So I wanted to get that feeling. And it's fast moving. It's I tried to make Widowland comedic. I tried to make it funny. And I think I'm sure all of your listeners have quite a knowledge of English literature, but I wanted to make people laugh as well as it be a thriller. And so I'm trying to keep a bit of that spirit in Queen High. And I want, I think some of it's funny. Just the idea of having to rewrite English literature is actually quite funny. But it's a very fast paced thriller, and it ends dramatically. And it's also great. And that's been huge fun to write. And Wallace is the gift that keeps on giving. And I'm sure we're all very interested in renegade Americans who don't like living in England and much rather go back to America and hate the regime and just feel jolly fed up. And I don't think that's an alien concept to any of us. So it's been fun.
That's brilliant. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Critic Books podcast. Subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.